Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Michael Paternity, whose latest book is The Telling Room, A Tale of Love, Betrayal, Revenge, and the World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. Also the author of Driving Mr. Albert, writes for GQ, Esquire, Travel and Leisure, many, many other places. New York Times Magazine, correct?
Right.
Travel writer, political and social journalist, and also a food writer. In reading The Telling Room, I realized about two-thirds of the way through that it is not a book about love, betrayal, revenge, and the world's greatest piece of cheese, but in fact a book about the nature of narrative, the nature of storytelling.
Yeah, it is. It is. There's some trapdoors in the book that you fall through, and then you finally, I think, figure that out.
It's about the writing of the book as well as the contents of the book. So there's several different ways to attack it. Let's first talk about the content before we talk about the wider version, which is the story of the writing of the book, because the events, most of the events happened over 10 years ago,
right,
and there
right.
were more drafts than you care to remember.
I've forgotten all of them. I have powerful amnesia at this point.
Insofar as I could tell, years ago, when you were working in the deli, you ran across this piece of cheese. You were editing the flyer about this rare piece of cheese called Paramo de Guzman?
Yeah, Paramo de Guzman.
This particular cheese, you kind of let it go, forgot about it, lived your life, and then you were looking through your memorabilia, I guess, and you came across it and thought about it, and you happened to be heading over to Spain anyway, and you figured you'd stop in. Is that correct?
That's pretty much it? Exactly correct. The newsletter was out of a deli in Ann Arbor where I was in grad school in 1991 called Zingerman's, and there was a four-paragraph entry about this piece of cheese that seemed like the beginning of a fairy tale. In fact, the cheesemaker's name I remembered from the entry being Ambrosio, which seemed like incredible, that alone. But it was the old family recipe that he'd recovered to make this cheese. It was the sheep that he milked by hand, the stirring of the milk over the fire, and the little stable that was across from his house, and then the family cave where he aged the cheese. It just seemed completely mystical and, like, fantastic. I kind of wanted to see it.
From what I understand about your life is you do that. You jump on trains haphazardly and your wife scratches her head and the kids go, oh, daddy's at it again, pretty much. So the idea in 2001 or 2002, you were interviewing Chef Ferran, correct?
Yeah, Ferran Adria, whose restaurant El Bulli became famous for reinventing cuisine as we know it. It was all about futuristic food for Ferran. It was all these foams and all this trickery that he was working in the kitchen and working with chemists, and sort of a very wild experiment that continues to this day. The restaurant is closed, but he now has a foundation in its place. And on an off day, on a Sunday, I went with my buddy Carlos, who was there translating for me because I don't speak any Spanish, and we took ourselves up to this little village in Castile, based on this entry that I proofread, you know, almost 10 years earlier. So we came to this little village of Guzman up on the Meseta of sort of north-central Spain.
What is a Meseta?
It's just a very high plain, really. And in the summer, it's really hot up there. So it's a very rugged landscape. About Castile, there's a famous quote that goes, there are 9 months of winter and 3 months of hell in Castile, and it's really actually true. You know, it's a pretty rough place. It's a hard place to, you know, hold on and survive in. So there aren't that many people up there. It's a little bit like South Dakota. And you come upon Guzman sitting up on this little hill. It has a population of 80 people with an average age of about 80, and the village is tumbling down on itself. I mean, it's beautiful. There's a huge church and a palacio, an old manor house that was built by the man named Guzman who started the village. But, you know, it's one of these dying places, one of these forgotten places. And on that day when we came into the village looking for Ambrosio and his cheese, we were directed up to his family cave. And above these family caves, they have built these rooms, these little hobbit holes, these cozy, cramped spaces known as telling rooms. And that's where families gather to this day, where they sit at these wood plank tables and have some homemade chorizo, some homemade wine out of the parón, which is the decanter with a spout on it, that they hold up in the air, and the wine arcs through the air and they catch it in their mouth.
Or not.
Or not, yeah. I wore a lot of wine in my time in Guzman. But Ambrosio was up there, and he threw open his door, and this is like a 260-pound giant of a man, just an absolute elemental force of nature. He took us in, and he began to tell the story of his legendary cheese. And when we came out 8 hours later, I mean, my head had exploded.
When you went up there, were you thinking, oh, this might be a nice little sidebar for food and leisure or something like that?
Yeah. Actually, it was more personal than that. It was like when you travel sometimes, you invent these little pilgrimages for yourself. I wasn't thinking about it necessarily as something I was going to write at first. I was just thinking of it as a way to actualize some younger part of myself. I remember being in that deli. I was in grad school. I was a fiction writer. And the owner of the deli, Ari Weinzweig, traveled the world finding all these foods to bring back. And he was like the Indiana Jones of food. You know, he'd go everywhere and find all these old recipes and stories, amazing products like, you know, finished black licorice and bring it back. And there was some part of me that wanted that life, even at the time when I was a poor grad student. So in a weird way, that trip up there was just to connect the dot, really, from the person I'd been in grad school to the person I was becoming as this magazine writer out in the world covering various stories.
Michael Paternity, at that point, you'd already published Driving Mr. Albert about going cross-country with Albert Einstein's brain. So at that point, you'd already kind of formed your own way of writing, which is your own way of storytelling, which is to incorporate your own life, various asides, travel, food. So you were already more or less in place for that.
Yeah, I think I have this interest in these hybridizations. I like a certain kind of book, and I like books that aren't exactly what they seem to be. So yeah, it's a very natural way for me to try to tell a story, is to just bring the whole world into something that might seemingly appear smaller than it really is. And by the time you're done with it, hopefully you've exploded it out into the big sort of Shakespearean themes that drive us as humans.
Well, I think what happened with the telling room is that it gradually turned into a kind of magnum opus for you, little bit more than you expected.
Yes.
It talks about the history of Spain, for example, the history of the region, the history of cheese. And the centerpiece is our friend Ambrosio Molino and his relationship with his best friend, Julian, and how they split apart over the cheese. And Ambrosio, of course, found himself thrown out of the company, plotted revenge, a revenge that, being Ambrosio, he could never accomplish. And you fell under his spell. You kind of became his acolyte.
I certainly did, yeah. I became his, like, mini-me from that very first time in the telling room, drinking wine for those first 8 hours. He told the story of the rise of this cheese, this little family cheese that had been made in a stable, and he told the story of how people in the village had tried it and passed it on to the next village, and everybody thought it was the most incredible cheese they'd ever had because it resembled these old cheeses, these old house cheeses that people made. And so people were reminded of their moms in the kitchen making this cheese. So there was a sentimental value to the cheese. And then it was passed all the way to Madrid. Cheesemonger in Madrid started to sell it. The royal family of Spain was served this cheese. Then the British royal family was served this cheese. Ronald Reagan was given the cheese, Frank Sinatra, and then Fidel Castro tried to buy all of Ambrosio's cheese. So out of this tiny village of 80 people, from this little stable, came this cheese that basically rocked the world. And Ambrosio, who's a fantastic and classic Castilian storyteller, doesn't tell a story that is free of hyperbole. Everything is exaggerated. Everything is epic. And so for him, of course, this was the world's greatest piece of cheese. And as he told his story, told how this, as the business grew, he was a farmer, and a storyteller and did not have the business acumen to necessarily bring in investors and move into a bigger facility. And that's where his friend Julian came in, who was a lawyer and a very smart business person. And Julian would put contracts in front of Ambrosio, according to Ambrosio, and he would just sign them. And somewhere in the process of signing these contracts, he said he had signed away the company. When he finally found out that he had, he started to plot the murder of Julian.
You eventually did talk to Julian, got a completely different story, and by the time you finished writing the book, which would have been less than a year ago, no conclusion had been reached. I mean, have you gone back? Have you tried to do any more research past the book?
Yeah, I was up in Guzman to see Ambrosio about 5 weeks ago. I became deeply implicated in this, you know, triangle between myself and these two old friends who had had this break in the relationship. One of the things that happens in the book is that there becomes this real narrative battle for who is going to tell the story, who the storyteller really is. Ambrosio is such a force, and for two-thirds of the book, he holds complete sway. And it is his legend of the cheese. And eventually, as time was passing, as publishing houses began to really doubt me, I had to wrestle this story back. And so I did end up in touch with Julian. And I felt like in some ways that was a betrayal, because Ambrosio over time had become like a family member. You know, he's become a very close friend in many ways. So somewhere in there, my journalistic instincts just went right out the window, and I was trying to prolong my experience in this place. It was really, in its own way, became this sideways spiritual quest that I was on to live more like he lives, live closer to the land, live the slow way, you know, telling slow stories instead of the 10-minute story or the 5-minute canned story or the soundbite. What would happen if you took 8 hours to tell the story? What would happen if you took a week or a year? What would happen if you took, as in this case, you know, 12 years to tell the full story? I went back. So this is where Ambrosio came to realize that this book was real. I came back. I had a galley of the book at the time, and I showed it to him. And there are many stories about other people in the village, and this village is like Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel. I mean, they're fantastical characters. There's a man named Manuel who allegedly flies, and there's a man named Honorado who wears two pairs of pants and can be found every day watering this little lawn. And there's no grass up in this part of the country, except his lawn is lush with it because his wife, who passed away, loved the lawn when it was green. And so he would water all summer just to grow what he could. So the book has all of this in it. I showed Ambrosio this map in it, and there's a picture of Manuel flying in the corner. He didn't dispute that Manuel was flying. He said, that doesn't quite look like Manuel. And then he said at one point, as he always does when I went to leave, hey, when are you coming back? Like, when am I going to see you again? And I said, I hope in the fall. That'd be very nice if I can make it back somehow. And then I jokingly said, you know, that's if everybody likes the book here. And he really, like, sort of stared at me for a moment, this long pause, and very seriously, the most seriously he's ever spoken to me, said, if people don't like it here, you best never come back.
Wow.
So this is what happens when you get into these tangled relationships. And so we're in a moment where we're going to have to redefine this, because he assumes that this book will be and should be a reflection of the legend that he delivered to me and that occupies the first two-thirds of the book. He may not be as prepared for the last third.
You leave that huge question, which is what really happened. We can't know.
We never know what really happened. I mean, this is what history it is. This is what every political campaign is. This is what every family dinner ends up being. It's a narrative collaboration. It's a narrative war. And there are great disparities depending on who the teller is. And the teller is often telling the story that he or she most needs to hear, him or herself telling, or to have others believe. So, you know, my suspicions, which are usually highly active as a journalist, kicked back in after some years in this place when I realized I had to actually get to the bottom of it. You know, of course, Julian has his story, and there are certain self-serving parts of his story. So you're right. The truth, whatever that truth really is, ends up being the substance that shapes these stories. These subjective truths shape these stories, but you're never going to find the objective truth. And somewhere in here, too, these stories kept changing. They would tell them over and over again, and there would be these changes, and character names sometimes would change inside of stories. So it became, for me, crazy-making, because you go back through your transcripts, and you were trying to figure out who killed who in the Civil War, and they were using different names to protect the families, and so it was very complicated.
There's one key element, which is that he signed away the rights without knowing he'd signed away his rights. Julian could just as easily have thought he said something to him, have thought this was obvious, but obviously it wasn't. I can't believe Ambrosio was lying about that. Can't believe it.
I think it goes to this very interesting thing about Ambrosio, which is that he is and sees himself as an old Castilian, somebody with this code from medieval times, really, going all the way back to El Cid, this man of honor and of faith. And so when you give your word, when you shake a hand, that's your bond. And what happened with Ambrosio is that I think he got caught up in these forces of modernity and got rooked a little bit by these capitalists who saw an opportunity. And he was naive, and he was living in his own sort of myth that he'd built about this cheese and never once thought that it could be taken from him.
At the same time, not to defend him here, but at the same time, his friend Julian's a lawyer, mm-hmm. and his friend Julian knew Ambrosio. Mm-hmm. And from that perspective, right, he should have been clear. There is no way Ambrosio would have signed those if Julian had been clear.
Yeah, we're taking Ambrosio's point of view. This is like the Rashomon version of this, is if you shift and you assume Julian's point of view. Yeah. Julian does have an argument for this, and he can catalog anecdotes and incidents that suggest that Ambrosio wanted more than Julian ever did to grow the company. He was desperate for investors. He was willing to sign what he needed to sign. That the company, in some ways, was in some financial shambles because Ambrosio was a farmer. He didn't care about the money, but he did care about the honor of being the man who paid the shepherds, the man who paid any number of vendors who came to the factory. And so Ambrosio put his name on all those contracts and ended up $3 million in debt. I mean, it was almost crazy the way he walked into that. And Julian argues that he desperately needed these investors to help lighten that debt. And he knew full well what he was getting into. He just didn't like the outcome, which was he got outmaneuvered and lost the company.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Paterniti, whose book is titled The Telling Room. I'm Richard Walensky. Let's broaden the narrative a little to the narrative itself about the book. But one final question, the cheese itself. You have tasted the cheese. I understand, according to your publicist, that the cheese, the newer version of the cheese, can only be gotten in Canada.
Yeah, I think you can get it in Canada and Spain. You can go to the Paramo de Guzman website. You wouldn't recognize this company. It's got this designy website, and they make wine, which I think they're maybe more known for now. It's something you can buy in certain places. You just can't buy it in this country anymore.
Putting aside everything else, probably pretty close to what Ambrosio made.
Right. Ambrosio always said that this cheese that was being made in this factory was this bastardized version of the pure thing that he made. He would call it the dead cheese. He would call it the soulless cheese. He would call it the crap cheese. Like, he just, everything about this counterfeit cheese to him was an affront. The truth is, the taste of it may be somewhat similar, but Ambrosio would argue that those sheep that grazed 20 years ago on the land near Guzman were eating chamomile and the herbs of that area, and that all of those things came out in the cheese. So you had a nutty tasting cheese with hints of chamomile. There was a sweetness to it and a buttercream, a very rich, strong, overpowering cheese. And really, this cheese, in the end, Ambrosio's cheese, which I had the luck and privilege to eventually get to eat. There was one tin of this cheese left. Is not something that you can eat like brie. You have one piece and you're done. And it really is, in some ways, the true embodiment of Ambrosio. It's just completely overpowering.
The narrative itself of The Telling Room took you so many years to write, and you kept rewriting it and rewriting it because you couldn't quite find the voice. And you took several contracts that you didn't fulfill, and your wife must have been kind of like, come on, Michael, do it for God's sake.
She eventually did. There was a famous moment where she sort of took me out to the proverbial woodshed and told me to get my act together. But, you know, all through these years, my day job was this magazine work. And so I came and went from the book a little bit more in the beginning. One of the things I found was every time I did a draft, I stopped at the end. In the summer of 2003, I moved my family over to Guzman. We lived in Spain for about 7 or 8 months. And when we left Guzman after that summer with two small children at the time, we had a third one later, I think if I'd sat to write that book, it would have been exactly as Ambrosio had described the legend. And so I kept writing these drafts that ended at the end of that summer. It was Ambrosio's story over and over again. And it wasn't until some time had passed, it wasn't until I could assess this murder plot, which was which was very vividly drawn. Ambrosio had this idea that he was going to take 1001 nights and turn it on its head. And Ambrosio, the classic storyteller, was going to kidnap Julian, take him to a faraway cave, tie him up, leave him for a while, return 3 nights later, set a perron of wine on the table, light a candle, tell him the story of their first merienda up at The Telling Room. As he said, all the beautiful stories of their friendship. And at the end of each one of these stories, he would take a knife and he would cut a little piece of Julian off and then cauterize the wound with a candle. And this was a real plot that he repeated and promised that he would one day find Julian. He knew Julian's every move. He was going to find him and act on this thing. So there was, you know, for a while there, it wasn't totally clear which way he was going with all of this. It was a great story, of course, and every time he told the story, he murdered Julian again in his mind. Something did shift. I think it was, as you were saying, it was the moment maybe where my wife said, you know, come on, man, you have to find an ending. This is your story. It's not his.
But you should have known that from the first book.
Yeah, every part of me knew it, but there was also this incredible fantasy that I was living by living inside of this world. In my day job, I went out and I might report a story in a war zone, or I might have gone to Cambodia to cover the genocide trials. But in America, after 9/11, this whole American narrative just collapsed. Whatever ideals we thought we stood for were challenged by Gitmo or the images out of Abu Ghraib. So there was this very interesting kind of disenchantment and alienation that didn't just belong to me. And then with the digital speed of our lives, you know, people, I think, have felt themselves disconnected from the things that give their life meaning. So when I went to Guzman, anytime I went there, anytime I was with Ambrosio and listening to his stories, and he told fairy tales and he told old legends and he told the histories of El Cid and old kings and queens, I was transported. I was like a child listening that first time to a parent telling a story. And I didn't want to lose that feeling, and I considered this place a refuge after a while. And so in order to tell the end of the story in my own voice, I knew that I was going to have to disrupt that. I was going to have to end up in this place that I ended up in 5 weeks ago when Ambrosio said, you know, if we don't like it here, you best never come back. And that was something I wasn't prepared to do. It took me 12 years to do it.
Those early drafts, were they kind of third-person Ambrosio? Did they have all of the asides about Spain and the Civil War?
Some of them did. I would say that actually the initial two drafts were combined and sort of became the front part of this book. There was a draft that was very voicey, and I created another persona that was me that became very complicated, like an overproduced, you know, pop song. It became headache-inducing, really. And while I thought it was really interesting, my editor broke the bad news to me that it was a little self-involved and monotonous, and I think part of that had to be worked out. These drafts weren't hard to write. It was always a pleasure to go back to the material. what was hard was it never quite lined up. And so the more I wrote about this cheese, the more the book mimicked this story that I was trying to tell. So Ambrosio's failure became partly my failure. Him going into debt left me in this place where eventually the British contract got canceled. So then suddenly I owed the British publisher some money. So in a weird way, it was like art imitating life and life imitating art, and I was caught up in it. The book was my own sort of quest that mimicked Ambrosio's quest to recover and make this cheese. You know, so I saw all of these nuances and refractions and reflections in the work, and I began to realize that all these drafts were just part of my own inner storyteller saying to me or suggesting that all of this needed to be in the book, that there needed to be these layers of storytelling. So what appears at first like a legend full of hyperbole and digression, which is very Castilian, becomes, at least in the last third of the book, something much more streamlined, mostly devoid of footnotes and digression, and kind of moves cleanly to some sort of self-revelation and conclusion.
How do you think writing on this book changed you as a writer? And I'm thinking specifically of your most recent stories for GQ, say on the rapper Drake, or on the story of the village that won a lottery, Sodeto, Spain.
That's an interesting question. I mean, writing the book, like writing anything, is this humbling act of trying to give voice to something you're hearing in your head, and then this narrative ambition that you might have to try to find the right way to tell a story, the right positioning, the right point of view, the right language. So what this book taught me was more than anything just patience. And it became for me like if this book was a slow food tale gone completely awry, then I was caught up in this act of slow storytelling. I think this book is one of those books that makes you slow down when you read it. It's trying to make you slow down when you read it. It's trying to really mimic that life and the virtues of that life, as well as the realities of that life, though some of them heartbreaking. So I think the patience thing is big. And then, you know, I think if you tick off a long list of any writer's stories, that you can't connect them all seemingly. Inside of each is this question. And so even when I was writing about, say, Drake, I was interested in his creative process. That became interesting to me. I didn't really care about the other stuff so much. You know, I'm interested in how the music gets made and how the layers get added and what's going through a creator's mind when they're in the process of trying to create.
Is that similar to, you also did a piece on Javier Bardem?
Yeah, those are the only two in, you know, whatever 17 years of doing this that are could be considered celebrity profiles. Everything else has been mostly about uncommon people who I think are the most interesting and who in some ways are forgotten by history but are the ones who sort of make history. In that Bardem piece, I became really most fascinated by how he spoke about this one movie, Beautiful. He was nominated for an Academy Award in that movie, and he was so angry at himself about his performance because he felt like in some scenes at the end he's on a bed and he's under incredible duress, and it's a very emotional scene, and he still feels to this day like he let himself come out in those scenes. He tapped into some emotion that was his and not the character's, and so that the person lying on the bed in those scenes in absolute distress was actually Javier Bardem and not the character. And to hear him talk about that and to hear his own sort of self-critique of that and his own disillusionment with himself about how he went about acting in that movie, a movie that was worth a nomination, I found that very fascinating, and I wanted more of that. You know, like, I don't really care who he's married to. I really care about that scene. Like, I could have talked for 3 weeks about that.
It's interesting when you talk about that, but it's also, in a sense, what you go through when you're writing these books. How much of this is me? How much of this is what I'm trying to do, the storytelling?
Right. And I think that's true in the magazine pieces, too. You take them in and you live them. I wrote a piece about a man who was caught up in the Japanese tsunami. He was on the back porch of his house when the wave hit. He got driven underwater, somehow came up alive, scrambled onto the roof of his house, and got dragged 10 miles out to sea, lived for 3 days on top of the roof of his house. And in writing that story, which ended up being in second person, you know, I found myself really trying to obviously put myself into his shoes, but also in the reporting of it, trying to ask all sorts of questions that, you know, one doesn't always think about just going out and reporting. I was trying to get the emotional part of it, and trying to get the gestures and the little movements that revealed things. And so in some ways, the story became this act of telling the story back to him as he had told it to me, because he's not a storyteller and he wasn't going to write it down. And so in order to do that, you have to believe that you can do it, but you also have to believe that you have enough material, you've gone inside deep enough into his world and his experience to repeat it back to him.
That's almost like acting, and it's almost like the storyteller, the novelist, inventing a character in a way.
Yeah, I don't think of there being any divisions between these acts of negative capability or emotional transference. Like, I just think it's part of what we do when we're looking at the world through empathetic eyes, trying to figure out how someone else may be experiencing their own reality. And so, yeah, in all of this, you get into a little bit of a fugue state where you become your subject and you get sucked in. You become the person at the prison camp in Phnom Penh who ends up in one of the photographs right before they're killed. You know, you have to understand maybe what that terror felt like in order to understand the entire experience. And you're never going to get it fully. And so the question is, how far are you willing to go to get some of it?
There's a certain point, though, I would think, where politics has to kind of creep in, and where at the same time you don't want your own prejudices and politics to influence you, and yet at the same time they have to. I mean, how do you deal with that?
That's such a good question. I think this goes to this central theme in the book, which is, there is a story that you tell yourself and that I tell myself, and we tell these stories about ourselves because we need to believe them. I'm attracted to underdogs. I'm attracted to people who have been discounted, because I think there's something powerful in some of these stories, like in The Village in Spain, where everybody won the lottery, and these were all sort of forgotten farmers suffering through this economic crisis. But I think it's this constant self-questioning that helps regulate. And it's also this questioning and questing in this job to find something out about other people. And then you write the drafts in hopes of reflecting back what you think is true. And that's where there's other input. There's my wife, who's a journalist, who will read. I've been so lucky and blessed to work with great editors. And those editors oftentimes can say in a word or two what kind of adjustment you need to make. So I'm not like deaf to all the voices and all the reflections coming back. And I don't think you can be if you're hoping to do something that's going to last.
Michael Paternity, you've covered Afghanistan. You've covered Guantanamo. Egypt?
Embedded with an Al Jazeera reporter in Egypt several months after.
Was there any premonition that what would wind up happening a year later would happen?
I think there were a fair number of people who knew that the euphoria of that moment couldn't last and it was going to be very complicated. It felt pretty complicated, even as people celebrated what they'd been able to accomplish. Tahrir Square felt, in some ways, like a symbolic thing rather than a real place. In order for Egypt to move beyond and iterate beyond that initial revolution, there were going to have to be a number of Tahrir Squares. And so Egypt is now in this moment of real crisis and conflict. Isn't that surprising? The question is just how bad will it get and what instability will it create in the region as a whole? And then you have other unstable countries around it that also last time around seemed to follow the lead of what was happening in Egypt. So it's really, there's this interconnectedness too that I think makes it all the more complicated.
Do you ever think about your own safety?
Well, I do with kids now. I mean, I didn't think so much about it before. I just have always trusted the people who were taking me into places. Like in Burma, I was taken into the jungles by some rebels, and I just trusted them. I felt pretty secure. I mean, you do a lot of legwork and you do a lot of trying to guess and minimizing of risk. But yeah, I think the last time, like when I was in Kabul, there was a moment that felt, you know, there were a couple of moments that felt a little more fraught. And I, as a father, was questioning myself, not because I didn't think I belonged there, but because when you're there, you want to go all the way. That's my impulse. And I was, you know, I found myself holding back a little bit and trying not to get into too much trouble.
Your family should be kind of used to it. Apparently, I was reading this interview you did a couple of years ago, the Neiman interview. At some point, you hauled your family off to India because you thought the heir to the French throne was there?
That sounds more whimsical than maybe it really was. We had some frequent flyer miles, and I knew I was going there to do this story. And the question was I going to go along, or were we going to all go? And we had the miles, and I just was like, what the hell? Let's just do it. Let's go. And Sarah, who does this work also, my wife, is not only an enabler, but she's an adventurer. So it's not just me. This is a collaborative effort. That trip is just incredible. And I was able to take a week in Bhopal where this gentleman was and do real reporting. And the family was able to keep busy. But we were also able to tack on some extra time.
Where was that published?
That was in GQ.
In another interview, you said, travel is partly about dreams and delusions that propel us towards something potentially unattainable. And adventure is what occurs along the way. What is potentially unattainable?
What's unattainable is this perfected version of yourself that you think you're going to find at the end of some trip or in some mountain village. I mean, in Guzman, I thought I was really going to find someone better than who I really am eventually. And I think over time you realize that life follows you and that your foibles follow you and your angels and your devils, and you're still that same person in this place. And you're trying as best you can maybe to be a good person, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you come back with the halo over your head because you set out on a pilgrimage and you made it to where you thought you meant to be, only to realize that it wasn't quite what you thought it was going to be.
What is the telling room in Portland, Maine?
So when we came back that summer, it was the summer of 2003, when we came back home to Portland, Maine, where we live, my wife and I, with our kids, we had talked about trying to start a little storytelling center, and we had the great luck to come through San Francisco earlier, an assignment, and just stopped here on the way to Asia. Dave Eggers took an afternoon, showed me around 826, was somebody who I had admired and had known from earlier in my magazine career, and just loved his writing and his spirit and especially what he was doing there. And so it just seemed so inspiring, and it was so easy to meld that idea with the idea of these real telling rooms in Spain where these families would gather to tell their stories. And we came home, and we thought about it a little bit, and we thought, wouldn't it be great if Portland had its own real telling room where we had kids and writers like ourselves working together and collaborating on stories, mainly just to dignify their stories, but that there was this cross-generational conversation and that people felt safe and secure in a room somewhere in that town to reveal themselves.
How's it going now? It's 10 years late.
It's been great. Last year we had 2,500 kids that we worked with. We've got 200 volunteers. We've got a great staff. And it's been pretty incredible. I feel like when we walk in there, I'm filled with a lot of hope. It could be a very dark, sort of rainy nor'easter day in Portland, Maine. And every time I come out of there, I'm psyched. You know, I'm smiling.
A couple of other questions. As a journalist, how do you look on the situation involving Snowden and the NSA? And have you ever had experience with whistleblowers?
The first piece I think I ever did was for a lefty paper called In These Times. And I was working with a whistleblower who was hiding out in Ottawa, but had been working in Texas at a power plant and had itemized a long list of violations there. This whistleblower felt really threatened and felt that his car had been manipulated. He was constantly afraid of being bombed. The story was important. It felt really important at the time to me. And it would have never been told had it not been for that whistleblower. The Snowden thing is interesting because in some ways it's important to separate out what it's become. I am very confused by this story on many levels. So I feel like that there needs to be a place where whistleblowers are protected. When they're national security secrets, you begin to frame it in a slightly different way. And I am just going to be very curious to continue to follow the story because right now my own little jury is out on this one. I can't quite square it. I mean, I don't know. What do you think about it?
Well, you know, what he revealed was something that many people suspected, but that nobody knew for sure. The extent, I think, shocked us all, and I think in a democracy, we need to know, if not the secrets, we need to know how safe we are mm-hmm. from, you know, people prying on us. Mm-hmm. And what's happened, turning him into the villain, or turning Greenwald or the Guardian into the villain, to me obscures the fact that no government should be able to know when we're going to the bathroom. I'm sorry. And mm-hmm. that's what it feels like we're moving into the realm of.
Right. Right. And I feel like that initial act of whistleblowing, though, has been so politicized that people aren't seeing it for what it initially was. So I think you're right, though. If you strip it down to what it is, if you were to silence him, then you would silence this man at the power plant, and you would silence all whistleblowers, and we would be living in a slightly different society.
And we may be going there anyway, because as electronics become more complex, how do we know how safe we are? And it gets scary in reading The Telling Room, because sometimes when I hear the Tea Party going at it, and I look at what happened in Spain, I wonder, how safe is America? Particularly, what if a Tea Party man became president? Mm-hmm. Where would the rest of us be? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just my thoughts.
Well, you mentioned the Spanish Civil War, and for me, I spent a lot of time in this book researching. And today, there are these groups of people who are trying to go back and dig up the mass graves, and there's been a lot of animus around this, and a lot of Spaniards want those graves to lay fallow. They don't want to dig up the bones because they feel that everybody is implicated in this thing. And once you realize that everybody's implicated, then the fabric of society is going to disintegrate and that they're going to go back to that. These guys who are doing it, and I would say I agree with them, think the opposite, which is we need to know the truth exactly. Who died where and how and when and at whose hands. And it's only when we know that truth that we'll be able to move forward as a society with complete transparency. And that transparency is what they predicate this idea of democracy on. And until they're able to do that, they feel like Spain is living a lie. So this idea that we were talking about earlier about the American narrative collapsing, I think this is another example of it. We believe one thing, or we want to believe one thing, and meanwhile, the government is monitoring. And I think maybe some of us aren't that surprised that they are, but as you say, the extent to which they are is the surprising part.
Michael Paternity, do you have any other stories sitting around that might become another book?
There's a long story list. Yeah, this is an interesting moment because I'm working on some magazine pieces, but I, for the first time, sort of opened the file the other night and started looking back at some ideas that are sitting there. So without mentioning them by name, I would say that there are a few that seem promising.
And I would hope that we don't see them another 15 years.
No, I'm putting myself on a strict schedule here. I'm going to try to be like most writers and use 2 or 3 years to get another book out.
I would think that Sarah would be holding a knife to your throat on that one, too.
Yeah, there's a little clock ticking that she's in charge of.
She also said that in some respects, the cheese is a MacGuffin for the Telling Room. Do you think that the best stories have to have one?
I think the best stories are never about the thing that they're acting like they're about. If that's a MacGuffin, then yes. I think you're telling a story about cheese, but what you're really telling a story about is the thing that you most believe in. You're talking about love and hate, and you're talking about grief and joy, and you're talking about the bonds between people that hold us together sort of in these communities and hold us to the earth. So I love, whether it's Einstein's brain, whether it's a piece of cheese, I mean, these are portals into deep, rich, weird, magical worlds. And when you find them, you hold on to them and you just see what comes of it. So I do love the MacGuffin, but, you know, more than that, I love what happens inside of these stories as you move past that sort of symbolic entryway and you get deeper into the real story, the story behind the story.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Paternity, whose latest book is titled The Telling Room, A Tale of Love, Betrayal, Revenge, and the World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. I'm Richard Walensky for Book Waves.